We always do it this way, and we have research lectures at night. And these are really meant to be, you know, the state of the art in what we can do. And this year we've asked the people giving these research lectures to explain a little bit to us how they got to where they got. Rather than just tell us about the biology, tell us about how they got there and something about the technology and the processing. So we're delighted to have Joachim Frank as the first research lecturer. And I realized earlier, I haven't done any introductions at all to any of the people talking, and nobody has. And I guess that's just a sign that these people are so recognizable in our field that they need no introduction. And I think that's very especially true of Joachim. So thanks very much, Joachim.
Thanks very much for not introducing me. Very flattered by this. So this is supposed to be classification in real life, and I put a lot of work on this after realizing that all the people before me really took these questions for real, and so I really had to insert quite a number of slides. So I found really by accident, I found this overhead from 1979, random conical reconstruction, and to explain to some people what my vision was. So it's 30 years, and it was a terrific find. as you all know, I've been looking at the ribosome for a long, very long time, and what is really more and more recognized through all the kinetic studies is that there are many distinct states, and this is probably an underestimation. There are many more, and for some of these states, we have gotten cryo-EM reconstructions over the years. And this is just the process of translocation. And here's the process of decoding. And both of them, along with peptidyl transfer, form the elongation cycle. So this gives you an idea about the kind of mapping that we need to do in order to get an idea about the entire process. You know, many of these transitions from one state to the other involve a very, very subtle conformational change, so it's probably going to be very difficult to get to this kind of resolution. And we could, you know, now we can go beyond this and sort of depict the whole a process of elongation and of translation, for that matter, as a free energy landscape, and which has its own ruggedness, and it has sort of deep valleys, and each of these valleys stands for a fairly stable position. So we could sort of say that the program of coming to an understanding of ribosome function is tantamount to mapping or sampling this energy landscape. And if we put it into these terms, then what we have done so far is at most anecdotal. We have sort of gotten very few of the points that we actually want to go for. So what kind of classification tools have accumulated over the time? But the supervised classification, I mean, this is really was not the first time that it was used, but I think it was the first time that it was very, very well documented and also put in the framework of what we've been studying, then focus classification, I think it's 2006, I don't know, 2005 or whatever, when Paul published a focus classification, which is really like supervised classification, but really looking at a particular region in the 3D structure, which can be highlighted by estimating the three-dimensional variance. This is not the first instance that hierarchical multi-reference has been used, but it has been really highlighted in Schütte et al. EMBO journal, where it's been applied to looking at the at one of the ribosome complexes. Maximum likelihood, I think, was a major step in the whole field, and produced a lot of expectations that we essentially we can solve every question in this way. And then more lately, the bootstrap method, the first publication is in Spahn and Penzec, current opinion, and we have something in press about this. So these are all the kinds of tools that are available, and but if you my agenda here is to tell you about sort of the real problems that one faces if one wants to solve a problem. You know, how do you solve a problem? You don't apply all these different methods. You sort of instinctively go for something that has the highest likelihood of getting somewhere. And depending on where you are, you know, you're excited about this here, or you're excited about that, and so forth. So you put all your weight into it, and then it can be disastrous, absolutely, because it could be that you don't have the right computing power to do it, or you don't have a deep understanding of this. And this is really, this is what happens in real life, that you might be thrown back by an entire year by taking the wrong approach. And so for it's probably useful to forget what you read in the normal research papers, because they are always, they're it's the history is on the side of the winners, okay? in general, and sort of all the losers, they're not being documented, so just bear with me. I'm in a certain sense I've been a loser in what I'm trying to present. So but I just wanted to show you a number of things where it worked. Where it worked and the circumstances under which it works. The real success stories were with some very simple idea, which is the supervised classification. And here is something that we published in 2008, and this is about spontaneous, which means factor-independent ratcheting of the ribosome. So there was this observation. Well, first of all, the whole ratcheting we discovered by Cryo-EM in the year 2000, and we found that when EFG binds to the ribosome, then the ribosome sort of makes this movement. The one subunit moves against the relative to the other and changes the conformation in a very major way. So then the thinking was, well, you know, the EFG somehow, by some kind of induced fit mechanism, brings the ribosome into the other conformation. But it turned out to be complete nonsense. Later, people found that the ribosome switches back and forth, essentially continuously, between the two conformations. And you can see this from going from the classic to the hybrid positions of the tRNAs, as reported by single molecule FRET. So when you have a pre-translocational ribosome, which means that it's a ribosome in which the peptidyl transfer has already happened, so it now waits for an action to go to the next state. So they discovered that it goes back and forth all the time. And the critical factor was really the magnesium concentration. The magnesium concentration was unreasonably above the physiological all the time. And I don't know why, but people just looked for stability of complexes. But this is more the physiological range. And then all of a sudden, it turned out that it's going back and forth all the time. So in fact, for 3.5 millimolar, two-thirds are in the hybrid state and only one-third are in the classical state, okay? So it's a complete inversion of the whole paradigm that was there before, because EFG was thought to be needed in order to bring the ribosome from one position to the next, okay? So EFG is not needed at all. What is it used for? well, it's good for a lot of things, but not for bringing the ribosome into the other state. So after learning about this, we prepared a specimen exactly under these conditions that were reported by a single molecule FRET people. And so if we took all the data, then we wound up with a ribosome reconstruction with completely unreasonable a distribution of masses in the intersubunit space. It could not be interpreted in terms of anything reasonable. And then, obviously, from the literature, we knew that the only reason could have been that the ribosome are in the two conformation. So it was absolutely reasonable to just present two references, one unratcheted, the other one ratcheted. So we see something like a shoulder, and so it suggested, well, why not just put a split here? We make an error, and I'm going to talk about this error in a moment. We make a mistake, because this is obviously something like a superposition of two Gaussians, where one runs into the other. But this is probably the best thing that we can do, this kind of split. And then we find that we wind up with two reconstruction which show the ratcheting in a very clear form. And what is even nicer, we for the first time find the tRNAs in these beautiful completely separated hybrid positions. So one of them is in the classical AAPP, and the other one with AP and PE position. So the AP, in fact, was for the first time shown here. And when we looked at the statistics, we found that 27% approximately were in the classic, and 73% in the hybrid state, and that was really corresponding to what was discovered in single molecule FRET. And so I just wanted to talk about this supervised classification with binary references. What is happening in between here? It's neither fish nor fowl, okay? What is happening here? Well, we have to get used to the idea that this is really the worst place to be, because these are all the structures that are dissimilar to both choices of reference. So this is where all the crap accumulates. Everything, an image of a piano, a walrus, everything is there, okay? This is very evident if you go into the multidimensional space. These reference one, reference two, okay? Well, these are all the structures everywhere that are equidistant from the two, okay? So this is the worst place to be. And that brings me to what Richard said. Richard said reconstruction is not that much hurt by inclusion of noisy outliers. Well, the noisy outliers are right in between, okay? So if we do the split that I just showed before, it's really not hurting. It's really not hurting. I'm sorry. Right here. It's really not hurting so much that we have a sort of a tail from here and a tail from there, because here we're all dealing with data that don't conform to either one. Okay. So the reconstructions that we see, and we see very crisply, are really carried. They are carried by this here and that one. Okay. And everything else is like structural noise on either end. So another example I want to get into is cognate versus near cognate decoding. So we have essentially decoding is based on the recognition of the anticodon and anticodon and codon match by the decoding center. And what happens if you have a near cognate match? Well, then you have essentially very weak interaction, and the hope to trap this complex are pretty slim. In fact, I didn't believe we were going to be able to do it. But this is a project which was successful in doing this in collaboration with Rachel Green. So what we did was we have ribosome programmed with cognate or near cognate codons, and loaded with initiation FMET, tRNA FMET in the P side, and they were incubated with ternary, with these ternary complexes in the presence of curomycin. So the cryo-electron microscopy was a very large data collection on CCD with the 300 kV Polara. And the total number of particles near cognate was 359,000, which turned out to be very clearly heterogeneous. And then there was another cognate data collection and an initiation-like, essentially for control purposes. So then we did supervised classification for the near cognate with a reference one being ternary complex removed by a soft masking, and the reference two, the ternary complex left in place. So this is now the distinction that is supposed to be recognized by the algorithm. So the interesting thing is now what is happening with this heterogeneous population. Well, 92% went with reference one, which meant completely with the empty ribosome. And 8% with reference two, and because of the much smaller number of particles, we only got 13.2 angstrom resolution. And here is the near cognate, here's the unbound. So this is, you know, fairly good resolution at 8 angstroms. And here, unfortunately, we only have these 8% and only got to 13.2. 13.2 is pretty good considering that we have only this fraction. But on the other hand, it's not so good because it's not sufficient in order to define the exact interactions that take place. But okay, here's the other comparison. But nevertheless, by comparison of the densities for the amino acyl tRNA, we find that essentially the bending that we had discovered by cryo-EM, you know, some time ago, like 6 years ago, is still happening. There's a kink and a twist in the anticodon arm, and then there's also something happening in the acceptor arm. So what we essentially see here is the manifestations of the decoding process itself. It is here somewhere because of the conformation of the tRNA, and given a certain threshold, there's a decision being made whether the tRNA is going to be accepted or not. So it's very exciting. It's very exciting because this is it. This is where things are happening. But unfortunately, we are only at 13 angstrom resolution, where something like the MDFF, the molecular dynamics flexible fitting, really doesn't take hold very well yet. So we get we got fittings of the entire ribosome and most of the EFTU, but at certain places where it counted, we didn't quite get a very good representation. And we could compare the coordinates that we obtained with the density maps, and we see that for the CCA arm, it sort of sticks out at places. So what it really means is that we have to get into a much, much larger data collection. I mean, it's like a factor of maybe 4 or so. So we have to go beyond a million in order to get there. And this really points to the need to streamline the whole data collection and come to a different way of how we do our projects. I mean, our projects that right now is sort of ad hoc. There's, you know, somebody sort of a postdoc is sort of doing his thing and her thing and focusing on one data collection, you know, putting it all into one notebook. And so what we really need is some kind of a pipeline procedure, and I think what we need is some kind of a screening or sort of pre-classification right at the microscope, as the data leave the microscope. So that seems to be needed. So I just wanted to give you examples of the various classification methods, and we collaborated with the Carazzo group in demonstrating how the ML3D is going to work, and our whole contribution to that paper was very minuscule. We just gave them 90,000 particles, and which which we sort of had classified by supervised classification. So here's the reconstruction without classification. We see the small subunit blurred, the EFG fragmented, so that it doesn't make any sense. When we use supervised classification, we get this neat separation This is a completely arbitrary division into five groups here, and we see that only one-fifth of them contain EFG and the tRNA in the PE position. All the other ones are essentially identical. So that brings me to a point, the validation of the dual reference classification. We've talked a lot about R3. Well, here's our version of R3. We omit data in the reference and see it and see if they pop up. And here, we presented references. Essentially, we presented the reference ratcheted or non-ratcheted, but all the factors carved out. They were not even there. Okay, so the real test was whether the data that were classified as ratcheting would have tRNAs emerging in the hybrid position. You know, so they have to really emerge from the data, and we have not put them in. And this is in fact what happened here. So they really popped out this here. All these masses came out from nowhere. They came from the actual data. These are the various groups, and these are the two references. And so ML3D came up with essentially the same classification. And since we didn't know what the actual classification, the actual classes of the data were, the supervised classification was really the only reference that we could go by. And so we saw that these 19,500 and the 15,800 had 11,400 particles in common. And I find this very impressive because I get a sense of the incredibly low signal-to-noise ratio. I mean, it's really fantastic that we get this kind of agreement between two completely independent methods. And we've been working on bootstrap classification, and this is an idea that was introduced by Paul Penzek, and essentially we're doing bootstrap sampled reconstructions from a very large data set, and then we subject these to principal component analysis, and that can tell us in the end how we can classify the projection data. And this is the test performance of this algorithm. Here are three different classes or prototypes, and here that shows you that we have a noisy, or it's point signal to noise ratio of 0.1, a noisy manifestation of one of the projections, and this is how it looks after CTF application and subjection to noise, and we get a very clear separation of these three templates. So now we come into a case study, and this is sort of the real sort of, I think, a highlight of this presentation here. And I'm gonna ask Derek Taylor in a moment to step up, because he's been part of this. He was a postdoc in my group and started this whole business, and it's still not finished. And it really shows you what an incredible challenge it is to get classification of these data. So all these people were involved, and the whole specimen came from Tatiana Pestova and from the SUNY Downstate Medical Center. And this is the ADS release complex. And that brings me to the titles that I promised you. One is Release of Relief, and the other one, Seeking Termination of an Interminable Project. And the third one is Eukaryotic Relief Factors 1 and 3. Okay. So translation termination is completely different in bacteria and eukaryotes. In bacteria, we are more familiar with this. RF1 or RF2 bind to the ribosome upon encountering a stop codon and then cleave off polypeptide chain. There's no GTP hydrolysis needed. It's just they simply cleave it off. And then RF3 binds to the 7DS and RF1 or 2 complex. And the reason why RFE3 binds is that RF1 or RF2 are so tightly associated with the ribosome at that time, so it needs a particular factor in order to cleave off the RF1 or RF2, and then in the end, RF3 dissociates. Termination process in eukaryotes is different. ERF1, there's only one factor, binds to the stop codon, and then ERF3 binds to the ADS, ERF1 complex, I'm sorry. And then GTP hydrolysis on ERF3 produces ERF1 cleaving off from the polypeptide chain. And then everything else follows afterwards. So the question was, you know, where are these located, and how can we understand the entire process? This is the work that we did before for the prokaryotes, and it showed that the RF3 causes the release of RF1 not by some kind of interaction, but rather it's an interaction with the ribosome, which produces a conformational change and then causes the RF1 or RF2 to leave. So this was work done by Haichao. For the ERF1 and ERF3 project, we know the X-ray structures that have been obtained by Cheng et al. It was recently published, and this is a complex of these two factors. So we know the X-ray structure, and then and this is the paper that I wanted to quote, and the beauty is that we now have an atomic map of the ADS ribosome, thanks to the efforts of Derek Taylor. I mean, it's a 2-year effort by the groups of Steve Harvey and Maria Topf and Andre Sali. So we have a fairly complete, 95% complete map. So the idea is if we can find the binding positions by cryo-EM of ERF1 and ERF3, and we can put it into this whole framework, and then we can really find the binding positions. And I think this is the time when I'd like to ask Derek to... Is he here? Okay. Yeah. Oh, you can.
Hello?
Okay.
No. It's good. Both switches. Okay, we'll try it the other way. Give it a second. Ah.
Okay, so Joachim asked me to introduce the case study, which is a project I had started in his lab, and after hearing him talk for a little bit, I started to realize this is one of those disastrous ones that was never going to end. So I'm very happy to see that something's coming of it now. And I think part of the problems was that the methods we were using for separating heterogeneity at the time weren't as sophisticated. At least what I'm hearing now, there seems to be more promise with using more modern techniques to sort this data set that I was invested in for some time. And so the problem begins with the eukaryotic ribosome is that the initiation is much more complex than in bacteria. And so instead of 3 initiation factors, we now have 13. And so to reconstitute this system, to have it stall at any point along the way, we first have to get through this step. So that's what we did. And then we added an mRNA with a tetrapeptide, which would express a get a tetrapeptide, and then stop with a stop site in the A site. And then we could go through elongation and have a programmed pre-termination complex. So we did that initially. And that's so it should look like this with the last tRNA in the P site and ready to have the release factors added. And what we realized, so we then could add the 2 release factors and see where they bound on the eukaryotic ribosome. And as Joachim mentioned, that this is a different complex, or the release mechanism is much different than bacteria too. So in this case, we could see both factors bound. And that's what we wanted to get 2 or 3 years ago. And so what we found along the way is that there's some contaminating ribosomes that just assemble and then co-purify throughout the process. So we had a vague idea from the beginning that we would have to separate these 2 populations. And then this is just the biochemistry that shows that in the pre-termination complex, that if we labeled the mRNA, then we get a band showing where it comes down on the gel. And then after adding the release factors, then there's a shift in the toe print. And so it shows that something's happening to all of the mRNA. At least we didn't see any second population. So biochemistry was telling us that this was fairly homogeneous. And then these are just some of those challenges despite all the work that's been done in ribosomes and the structures, there's still a lot of ADS complexes that haven't been worked out. And so in this case, we're using the mammalian ribosome, which is almost twice the mass of the bacterial ribosome, so we didn't really have any references to work with, and we had to generate some of our own. And then additionally, so we wanted to sort where the 2 factors bind independently, and what we realized is that our population has some with RF1 ERF1 bound alone, and some with the second factor bound alone, and some with both. And then we can't just look at where the density of these factors bind, because the binding of each one induces the different conformational changes in the ribosome. So to start, we just assembled the pre-termination complex with no factors, and to get a starting reference of what we should be looking at for the programmed ribosome. And we did a quick investigation with 22,000 particles. And then the reference we used was an empty ADS ribosome that Christian Spahn had worked on when he was in the lab. And if we use that as a reference, then we realized that our projections after alignment then just calculate the cross-correlation of our data to the reference, then it's a bimodal distribution. So we just split this in half right down the middle and did 2 different reconstructions based on this. And what we found was that what we have a good population where the cross-correlation matches better to the reference than this bad population. And the difference was that this one was truly programmed, and we could tell because it had density for the P site tRNA, Whereas this one had pore density in the P site, and there was some density in the E site, which was just nonspecific. And then this just shows again the percentage based on cross correlation to the reference that we found about 38% were truly programmed, whereas the others were just empty and contaminants. And then if we use those two references that we generate and did real supervised classification, then we're still at about 32% is what we wanted to have, and 70% is garbage. So we were able to generate a low-resolution structure of the pre-termination complex. And so then we started adding factors to this specimen. And this just goes through it again. And so at the time, we knew we would have potentially, so we knew we were starting with two different populations, and then if we were adding two different factors, that we could end up with a whole lot of different populations, the programmed with one factor or the other, or with both, and then also the non-programmed with the same situation. In hindsight, we probably should have done the reconstruction of each of these on their own and got some good references to go on. But I was a little overzealous and just did it all at once. And this was when maximum likelihood was coming out. And we thought we could just separate everything from a single population. And so we used autoemation on the Polara and collected data for 10 days in a row, and 10,000 micrographs on a CCD camera, and using the cross-correlation match with a reference, ended up with almost a million particles. And then we used TAPU's verification program to use multivariate data analysis and classification to sort out, to do it semi-automated, and what we could do was just quickly throw away the projections that didn't look good in the class averages, and then manually sort the ones that are good. And by doing so, we ended up with 430,000 good particles. And then again, just comparing to the reference that we were using now from the preliminary study, we find that 324,000 of those probably have P-site tRNA in them, whereas the others do not. And so we did a reconstruction of those better ones and looked for just where the factors would bind in the ribosome. And we do see density there, but this one, the weaker density was where ERF3 would bind, and then in the inside is where ERF1 would bind. So here's where we tried sorting. At least with supervised classification, we weren't too successful because we didn't have the reference of one or the other versus the whole thing. So we did, with the 430,000 with the 400,000 particles, we omitted some that were just didn't match well, and then with the remainders, we did supervised classification just to determine which ones had factor density and which ones had none at all. And so we ended up with... So 195,000 out of the original million have some sort of density here, and that's where it was stuck at the time. And then I think Giacomo will tell you how they've been able to sort that out.
This is just a repeat. Okay. I think at this stage we got pretty desperate. Derek was leaving, and essentially, you know, we were thinking the whole thing was an utter failure. And then at the resource in Albany, we happened to have the whole heterogeneity issue as one of the agendas. So Bill Baxter, was able to... work on this and put all his weight into it. And at the same time, Cao Liao in my group could work on it at the same time. We thought we'll just give it two shots rather than one, and one worked on multi-reference and the other one on ML3D. So this is the sort of the scheme for the multi-reference, and I, you know, can show you what happened. So we have various rounds of this. And unfortunately, in all these different rounds, we just don't get an enrichment of a complex in which ERF3 is seen as a separate mass. So the whole thing really didn't work out very well. And at the same time, Tsao came up with these ML3D classifications that also showed a mass, but it was again not very conclusive. This was done on a decimated volume, because the idea is that, you know, we only are interested in something that affects rather big domains. So why throw all the computing power into all this original sampling? And so what finally turned out to get as a breakthrough was really a cross classification. We looked for which population would go with one and the other. Okay, so we got cross populations. We simply look at the matrix of one classification against the other classification, and then looked at all the different reconstructions, and then finally we were able to, find four. One of them is empty, which is not very interesting to look at. One of them contained ERF1 and ERF3, one ERF1 alone, and one ERF3 only. So finally, after going all through this business, we finally were successful. But there was really no indication at the start how we would wind up with this kind of strategy. We in that table we simply looked for particles that went into ML1 and MA2, or ML1 and MA2. Okay, so we actually singled out the particles that went with both classifications, and so we potentially get 4 times 4 different reconstructions. And then we looked through all of them, and some of them were completely uninteresting. They were noisy, or they were empty, and so forth. And then they were just four that were interesting, and they showed the actual factors bound in the different positions. So it could be, I've been thinking about this, it could be that the repeated application of ML3D with different seeds might have done the same thing, you know? It is simply sort of giving, producing tests for the same particles twice in a row in order to find out which are really committed to a particular population.
So, but if you had chosen 16 references initially at random through some 1/16th of the populations and built references and then sort of iterated on those, like Nico was proposing, you know, do you end up with the same kind of results of being able to sort out?
I don't. I don't know. That's the whole point, you know, because this is a case study. You know, we're doing whatever we are excited. You know, we are almost there, and then it takes much longer than we estimate, and then we wind up with this here. So now, I think so. The take home message here is. This whole thing looks like a very erratic process. I mean, because you know, this is not something which we would come up with if we had designed the whole thing. This is out of desperation. We really wanted to get a classification, and then you know, it's like 2 weeks ago, we got this here, and it's great, but. Something feels not good about it, you know, because you know, what do we do in another situation? I don't know.
There seems to be lots of correlations, you know, between the different classifications, at least that's in terms of particle counts, right?
Yeah.
So that they're not really independent, they don't look like they're really quite independent models. And so could one have done some kind of three-dimensional PCA or something?
You might be right. You know, even throwing all the eight into PCA might have given us something, right? But these, I mean, this is really the case study. We made the decisions at certain times, and they might have been stupid, but you know, in the end, they got us somewhere. Okay, so. So now I come to the questions, of course, because I learned from Richard that I can just throw them in at the very, very last moment. So how was variability detected? Well, local blurring, I already mentioned this, the appearance of physically impossible density regions, fragmented or overlapped density of ligands. How were various populations sorted and averaged? Well, see above, not on this slide, but see above the entire lecture. And what were the thought processes and decisions made along the way? Well, always, you know, we want to get it done, for Christ's sake. We want to get it. So, so how were the various problems that were encountered solved? But tenacity, you know, because it is a project, it's a funded project, you know. We have to stand up for it, you know. We have to say what we have done, you know. People have gotten salaries, and why? So I have to, what's the pipeline in terms of new approaches? Data collection needs to be streamlined. I already said this before. And screen at the very first opportunity, data coming from the EM. What does not work? God, I ran out of space. I'm sorry. I swear I put down an answer. I don't know. So I just wanted to bring up one thing, which you know, when classification works, when it works very well, then this is really the cool thing to do. Time-resolved cryo-EM. In Albany, just after I left, they were successful with getting monolithic microfluidic mixing and spraying device to work for time-resolved cryo-EM. It is, this is the paper that has just come out, and the time resolution is down to milliseconds, and it's all done here in the context of the resource in Albany. And Tapu has been one of the main players there. And this is these are devices which are really absolutely tiny. It's nanofabrication done in collaboration with RPI, and they have reaction chambers which are designed for mixing, for period of time, like, you know, 30 milliseconds or 400 milliseconds, and then spraying is done essentially without delay. Spraying and freezing is without delay. And this is sort of proof of concept, because in this case, 30S and 50S are sprayed separately, and it was shown that they actually form a 70S, and this is a reconstruction of the 70S that was formed, and what is more, it was tested for activity, it was fully functioning as a ribosome. So that's, it's really beautiful, and that gave me hope that we are able to essentially design experiments that take advantage of this and follow the course of decoding process and translocation process over millisecond range. And so we can, using the existing kinetic data, we can make a projection of how all the different states evolve over time. Decoding is the most challenging one, because we essentially have to get to reaction times of 50 milliseconds. The when we combine decoding with translocation and peptide transfer, we can really go on to 500 milliseconds. And the more interesting things, I don't have a slide for it, more interesting things are now happening between here and 500 milliseconds. So it's very exciting, especially if we really get to a solution of the of the classification problem. I mean, you might think that this is what I presented is really makes everybody feel rather pessimistic, but I think just listening to all the presentations that have been here before, that there are so many ideas, both published and unpublished, that we will probably get breakthroughs in a very in the near future, and then finally, what we need to do, because we get into the millions of particles, we need to do acceleration of computing, and we've also done forays in this area. We now have acceleration of supervised classification, which is inherent in projection matching by a factor of 100, and which will soon be incorporated in SPIDER. Okay, thanks for your attention.
Getting your expenses.
Why not?
No, that's right. Can I have the microphone? Derek has the microphone. It's
So you have mentioned briefly in between that maybe the 3D map theorem likelihood refinement would have yielded a different result if you would have used different seeds. So can you comment on the dependence of the result of 3D maximum likelihood alignment from the seeds, so the initial reference that is used, so to say? I mean,
well, I don't know that much about it. Bill Baxter has done, you know, some systematic work on it, and so he got, but it was a fairly small data set. It was 10,000, and for the 10,000, he got some kind of a reproducibility of maybe something like 85%, and then it seemed to get much better when he went to 20,000. So there seems to be some kind of a critical limit. that you have to go beyond in order to get the right answer. Rightness is by reference to a phantom data set, which we created some time ago, by the way. Yeah?
Okay, I'll sprint. Chariots of Fire could be playing, yeah.
Jochen, I'm just wondering if this might be accelerated by considering other techniques that might inform the problem. For instance, instead of just taking this massive amount of data and trying to sort it out, what do you think of, you have some idea of where the factors might bind so that you imagine generating a couple thousand mutants with cysteines that might be in proximity so that you can bias the biochemistry in your favor so that you can start to covalently attach some of these components and then check activity so that, you know, hybrid methods with mutagenesis and judicious cross-linking.
You're suggesting to do reconstructions for each of these mutants?
No. So no. That you would generate the mutants, and then you would assay whether or not they're active. So you can at least assess biochemically if the components are present in your population, and then check for activity, and then select those that are bound and active, and then proceed with EM.
Yes, Derek can comment on this because I wouldn't even know how much work would be involved.
Or maybe the focus classification.
I think what we should have done is the focus classification in order to at least narrow our attention to one particular region of the whole ribosome, and so that was sort of, I think, you know, we might have done it differently if we had the full information now.
Well, we really appreciate the honesty, you know, and I think it's terribly important to discuss these real world problems, you know, not make it look so easy. And you know, if you know the details, it's a little easier to face the problems and to know that they're real, not, you know, that you're stuck in some bottleneck. So really appreciate it. Thank you.